This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the room in the metaverse where in 28 minutes you and I go to try and understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the invasion of Ukraine has caused a fundamental rethink of policy in Germany. How's that going? Few countries have had a bigger adjustment to make to the realities of Russia's aggression against Ukraine than Germany, the economic powerhouse of Europe. In late February, the new Chancellor, Olaf Scholz, described the moment as a Zeitenwende, a turning point. But saying it is one thing, doing something about it another. So how far has Germany turned? And how much turning has it left to do? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, let's look at the part that relations with Russia have played in post-war Germany. Sir Paul Lever is a former British ambassador to Germany and author of Berlin Rules, Europe and the German Way. Now, a lot of people think of Germany as being essentially post-war a pacifist country. Has that been true?
No, I don't think it's fair to say that Germany was pacifist. I mean, from 1955 onwards, Germany was a loyal member of NATO and its leadership often took decisions which were not popular. I would say Germany was more anti-militarist. There's no tradition in Germany of being proud of your nation's armed forces of the kind that we have here. There are no events, there are no parades, there are no public manifestations of support for the German armed forces. For a long time, they've been regarded as more of a necessity than something that was loved. In the immediate period after 1945, there was no talk of Germany having its own armed forces. It was, in theory, supposed to be a unified country one day, but as the years went on, it became pretty clear that the Soviet Union was not going to give up control of the eastern part. Then there was the Berlin airlift, and it wasn't until 1955 that Germany got its Bundeswehr, its armed forces, back and joined NATO.
And that presumably was in the western part of Germany. I imagine that it doesn't seem terribly relevant now that East Germany also rearmed.
It did, more or less in reaction to what happened in the west.
So what you have is West Germany on the western part of the Cold War and East Germany on the eastern part of the Cold War, so to speak, in different camps. West Germany in the 60s, having been part of this Cold War, was then debating a new policy, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, Germany was always, West Germany, was always a loyal member of NATO and its armed forces were effective. It struggled to spend the 3% NATO target on defence. But there was always in West Germany a feeling that defence, yes, but it must be accompanied by some form of political engagement. And under Willy Brandt, it developed the policy that became known as Ostpolitik, a policy of engagement with the East. It later became a German term called Wandel durch Annäherung, change through proximity. The theory was that if you engaged with the Soviet Union, with the Warsaw Pact, if you embarked upon a pattern of various political and economic agreements with them, this would soften the effect of the division of Europe and the division of Germany.
Now, the wall falls,
Germany becomes unified. Under those circumstances, how did the successors of Brandt seek to manage the relationship with the new Russia?
Well, they were, in retrospect, perhaps a bit naive about it. But they weren't the only ones. I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, under Gorbachev, under Yeltsin, some would say even in the first couple of years under Putin, it did look as though a new relationship with Russia was possible. Also for the Germans, they felt an enormous sense of gratitude to Gorbachev personally for enabling reunification to come about peacefully. It wasn't self-evident that this would happen. It was largely due to Gorbachev's own, I think you have to say, moral courage in doing it. And he's always been a hugely popular figure in Germany as a result.
Well, that's psychologically quite important. So there is this sense of gratitude to a Russian leader for allowing this new situation to come about. And I presume that, therefore, the internalized lesson is we can get somewhere when we talk to people and are pretty nice to them.
Yes, there's always been a strong strand of that in German foreign policy, a feeling that you have to talk. They apply it also to their dealings with China, where the phrase Wandel durch Handel, change through trade, has been rather a leitmotif of the way they view things. It's rather self-serving, of course, if you're a big, big trading nation yourself. But still, there is a sense in Germany that you need to engage, you need to talk. And that continued through the Angela Merkel years to what now seems an excessive and rather blue-eyed degree.
So Angela Merkel was as keen on this rapprochement as her predecessor Gerhard Schröder had been.
Yes, Gerhard Schröder is now a much maligned figure because he's taken the shilling of Gazprom.
The Russian energy company.
The Russian energy company, yes. And it was under Schröder that the first Nord Stream pipeline was agreed. But it was under Angela Merkel that the second one was approved. And that was after the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. And a whole generation of German politicians, not just Angela Merkel, but the now President Steinmeier, and even Friedrich Merz, the leader of the CDU, they were still keen on trading with Russia right up until not many months ago.
Schröder had a much publicised friendly relationship with Putin. In other words, they were supposed to get on with each other. Did Merkel personally get on with Putin?
Up to a point. Merkel spoke Russian and Putin, of course, speaks German, rather good German. I heard him give a speech to the Bundestag in German. It was a much better speech than the one President George Bush gave a few months later. I don't think she was taken in by him, and he certainly didn't always behave in a very friendly way towards her. He knew that she didn't like dogs, and once when she came to call on him, he produced a very large black Labrador, which rather growled at her in the hope of putting her off her stride. So I don't think you could say that they had a warm personal relationship, but she had grown up in the East. The Soviet Union, Russia, was rather more familiar to her than it would have been to most other German politicians.
Sir Paul Lever. The 1,000-kilometre pipeline-sized problem at the heart of Germany's current dealings with Russia is energy. Just how did Germany get to be so dependent on Russian oil and gas? Professor Markus Zehner is Helmut Schmidt Fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, a non-partisan policy organisation. Markus Zehner, when did Germany's energy relationship with Russia begin, and how has it developed?
Well, this relationship dates back to the late 60s, when then the former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Willy Brandt, actually, he was the one who was trying to, well, put relations with Russia, with the Soviet Union, on a better track. I mean, that was at the height of the Cold War, and he wanted to ease the tension. That had to do with the fact that just a couple of years earlier, the wall was built. So the whole idea behind this energy relationship was also a political one. In order to improve relations, the idea was to do something on the energy front. Then in 1970, when Willy Brandt was actually the Chancellor of Germany, he was signing a treaty, a contract with the Soviet Union, to the effect that Germany was sending pipes to the Soviet Union, and in return, the Soviet Union would send gas to Germany. And this was the beginning of this energy relationship.
How did the way in which Germany derived its energy and chose to derive its energy impact upon its relationship with Russia?
It has a lot to do with what happened in Chernobyl in the 1980s, because the meltdown of the Chernobyl nuclear power plant was giving a boost to those who were saying, well, nuclear energy is too dangerous a technology really to handle, and we should get out of nuclear energy. If you look at the numbers, they skyrocketed after Chernobyl, the numbers of supporters of saying, well, we have to get out of nuclear power. And this was in the beginning that was not really shared by all the political parties, but it became stronger and stronger.
In 2011, there was the tsunami in Japan and the threat to the Fukushima nuclear plant. How was that reacted to in Germany?
Fukushima had a huge impact on our energy policy, because just a couple of months before Fukushima happened, Angela Merkel, the chancellor, she decided to extend the runtime of the existing nuclear power plants in Germany. There was the overall consensus that we have to phase out nuclear energy, but the question was, okay, when are we going to do that? And before Fukushima, she said, okay, let's have them in operation a little longer than we originally planned. But then happened Fukushima, and what Angela Merkel did was nothing less than an about face. And she said, this is just too dangerous, this technology, and we have to go out of nuclear energy quicker.
Now, subsequently, it was discovered that the impact upon Fukushima had been pretty minimal. And certainly in the case of France, they maintained their nuclear power strategy and so on. Did Germans not look at that and think, well, maybe the French have got a point?
When it comes to CO2 emissions, of course, the French have a point, because it's much more environment-friendly power source. On the other hand, if you talk to environmentalists in Germany and to the Green Party, I mean, they're always saying, well, probably we're better able to handle the nuclear power plants today than we did in the past, but we still don't know really where to dispose of our nuclear waste, a nuclear waste that radiates for another million years or so.
The Russians annexed Crimea in 2014 and were involved in Ukraine militarily at that point. And yet Germany still went ahead, didn't it, with the big new pipeline idea, Nord Stream 2. Why did that go ahead after 2014?
The pipeline Nord Stream 2, which basically doubles the capacity of Nord Stream 1 running through the Baltic Sea, was put on track in the last days of the chancellorship of Gerhard Schröder. And Angela Merkel, when she took over, she continued with that, even after 2014, after the annexation of Crimea. That has to do with the simple fact that by phasing out our CO2 fossil fuel energy sources, we had to do something with this gap. Electricity from renewables is currently running at about 40 to 45%. And it will take another, 10 years or so until we're probably somewhere in the range of 80 to 90% electricity, not heating. So we still need time to compensate what we are not having by phasing out coal and nuclear. And we want to compensate that with energy from Russia.
Did anybody in Germany stop and say, hold on a second, this is leaving us very vulnerable because all of us, so much of our energy now comes from this one place, from Russia?
The voices in Germany were not that loud, to be honest. I mean, there were voices coming from Eastern European countries, from Poland, from Ukraine, also, of course, from the United States, always warning that this is going to be too big of a dependency from Russia and we should be careful about it. But within Germany, I think that there was this understanding, and that has to do with the past and our past experience with Russia and the Soviet Union. It will continue, and the dependency we can manage that, we can handle that. And I think that led us to an illusion about the political implications all this had. And now the Poles and Ukrainians, of course, are saying, well, you should have heard earlier, and now you're in a big mess.
Markus Seeler. It's obvious that the invasion of Ukraine posed difficulties for Germany far beyond those for us here in Britain. In February, Olaf Scholz announced a significant shift in foreign policy to try and deal with those difficulties. But how's it going? Joining me in the briefing room are Professor Daniela Schwarzer, the Open Society Foundation's Executive Director for Europe and Eurasia, and Sophia Besch, Senior Research Fellow at the Centre for European Reform, where she specialises in European defence issues. Daniela Schwarzer, in February, Olaf Scholz announced the Zeitenwende as a response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Now, what exactly in that speech was he proposing?
First of all, he analyzed the world and he said that Zeitenwende is really what is happening around us. And he described the context of the war in Ukraine and he basically said, this is an attack, a Russian attack on freedom and democracy in Europe. And then he gave a German response. And that was, first of all, that defense expenditure will increase significantly. He promised that Germany would straight away, so in the year 2022, meet the NATO 2% of GDP defense targets. And he also announced that a special defense fund of 100 billion euros would be put into place to fund necessary investment into German defense. He also said that Germany would strengthen defense cooperation in Europe, and in particular with France, a country he singled out in that speech. And then he went on to speak about energy and announced that Germany would reduce its energy dependency on Russia. A final thing that actually happened 2 days earlier, but was confirmed in that speech, was that the government also decided to deliver arms to Ukraine, which really is also a pretty fundamental policy change. And underlying all of this is a real change of Germany's policy towards Russia.
Sophia Besch, was this seen in Germany as a really big shift of policy?
Yes, and it's an implicit acknowledgement that the previous German positions were wrong, or at least they're no longer appropriate, right? So Zeitenwende in the first instance is a declaration that Germany intends to catch up to the expectations of its allies to do things that it had either long promised or had long been asked to do. And Germans are not completely new to these kinds of shifts. We've had major shifts like this in our recent history. If you think of the German decision to exit nuclear energy, for example. But for now, this is just what it is. It's a declaration of change. It's an announcement of changes. To turn those into a more sustainable policy change will require more than just a speech.
Now, Daniela, this happened in the context of a new government. Angela Merkel had been chancellor for a very long time. There was an election last year and a new government comes in. Presumably, this has not been easy for that new coalition.
It's a challenge for all three parties. First of all, if we go back to what we just said about defense spending and the defense fund, this is a particular challenge for the Liberals, for instance. The finance minister, who is the party chair of the Liberal Party, had actually very different ideas of budgetary policy and didn't want to run such a high deficit that Germany will now run. For the Greens, obviously, delivering arms into a conflict, just like for the SPD, is a big issue. And the Social Democrats also had to review years of their Russia policy. The SPD had been in the previous government and had actually argued, for instance, that Nord Stream 2, this extra pipeline that was being built from Russia to deliver gas right into Germany, that this was just an economic project, nothing big political. And they had tried to hold up this narrative for a very long time. But of course, it was always a political project, part of a broad policy that assumed that if we build a very close partnership with Russia and create mutual dependencies, then we would have a stable relationship with this major player on the European continent. And this all had to be revised, and it's a big challenge for all three parties involved.
Another issue for the coalition is the nuclear power plants. Will the Green Party consent to keeping them open longer to deal with this energy crisis?
At the moment, this does not look very likely. It is highly costly and in some cases technically not really possible. The Green Party has slightly had to change its views on alternative sources for energy. And so the Green Minister of the Economy and Climate traveled to the Gulf States pretty early after the war broke out to negotiate a new deal with Qatar on energy provisions, because the real declared goal right now is, on the one hand, yes, to pursue energy transition and to go away from fossil energy sources, but at the same time, to press ahead with reducing energy dependency on Russia.
Sophia Besch, let's look at the defence spending question. Lots of people have criticised Germany over the years, as we've talked about, for its lack of commitment to defence spending. And now Germany is going to do that. And of course, Germany is the most powerful economy in Europe. So that 2% is a lot of defence spending. That will please critics in some places, but presumably it's going to worry some other people in Europe.
Well, that is an interesting question. So I think, yes, in the future, Germany will have the biggest military budget in Europe. Of course, money is not everything, right? So there are questions over how to spend it, whether we'll be able to channel the money to fill the longstanding capability gaps that we have and to, you know, live up to the commitments that we've made to our allies in NATO, which were sort of under question recently. It's going to take time to turn this around and make up for the decades of underfunding that we have seen. And then the question remains also if we will have the political will to deploy those forces in the future, right? And change a very risk-adverse approach of the last years, change our restrictive rules of engagement. We've been very happy in the past to derive most of our strategic goals and objectives from NATO. And in the EU, we've been pretty happy to concede the leadership on defense question to France. So a bigger military does not necessarily a leader make. And so concerns over whether Germany is going to take on a greater leadership role on defense in Europe, I don't think are necessarily justified just seeing the changes in defense spending. But, you know, I believe that we can get there. I think that we can, by following our course of, you know, embedding our security and defense policy deeply in our alliances like the EU and NATO, appease those that might be concerned over Germany taking an extra route, a special path forward.
But in this context, there's been some suggestion in reports over here that Germany's initial commitment, for example, to supply lethal weaponry to Ukraine has not been as fulfilled as it might have been. Is that the German perception? Has there actually been some form of restriction?
Yeah, so I think what we see in Europe right now is that expectations have risen and patience with Germany has worn thin. So I think the speech, the Zeitenwende speech, was welcomed, but the effect was slightly undermined by what was seen as a reluctant follow-up and obstructionism by the government, be that on energy embargoes or on weapons deliveries. I think that Berlin is moving and has moved on those questions, but the Chancellery is sort of making decisions in its own time, and that has cost us. So even the Zeitenwende speech came after a few days of intense criticism of Germany blocking on sanctions and weapons deliveries. And I sometimes think that the intention here in Germany is to be under-promising and over-delivering, you know, first saying that things are impossible and then finding a way to make them happen after all. But that's not how it's read abroad. It's read as reluctant and egoistic, or as at best chaotic, I would say. So the war has also, I think, demonstrated how misguided some of Germany's assumptions were. And the Zeitenwende is seen as too little, too late, too slow by some. And that criticism is understandable, you know. In reality, the world did not suddenly change with the Russian invasion. Berlin had ignored the warnings of its allies, particularly its Central and Eastern European neighbors, for years. And a lot of them are not giving Berlin the benefit of the doubt. You know, the Scholz government is going to have to prove itself in Europe. And the discussion over lethal weaponry, the discussion over heavy weapons, is one example of Germany quite reluctantly, quite slowly changing its position when some may have expected after the speech that this would happen much quicker.
Now, in many ways, Daniela, doing the military stuff is the easy bit. The energy dependence is far more difficult, as we've already heard. How do you think Germany is going to progress with decreasing its energy dependence on Russia, and how long will it take?
It's a parallel track, and indeed it's a longer term project, and it's costly. So the first track is really the green transition of the economy and investment into renewables, and really sort of an acceleration of a program that had been laid down in the coalition treaty anyway, and which carries a very strong green handwriting. But the other track is to replace Russian oil and gas by other countries. And one of the decisions that the Chancellor announced in his speech on February 27th is the construction of liquid gas terminals. So, for instance, Europe could import liquefied gas, could be shipped to Europe, and then would be landing right in Germany. you know, our Minister of the Economy and Climate, as he flew to Qatar really only days after this announcement. Of course, for a Green minister, this wasn't an easy trip because, yes, he strikes a deal there. But at the same time, the Greens came in with a very ambitious human rights agenda. And then, of course, traveling to a Gulf country, he had to explain, why are we now, you know, striking a quick deal? Will there be a human rights conversation in parallel? And so, you know, the Greens are facing multiple problems at the same time. One is that the minister has to make sure energy provisions are secured for Germany. The second one is the green transition agenda. And the third one is a pretty ambitious foreign policy agenda that also the Green foreign minister defends.
Back during the election in 2021, Olaf Scholz talked about a new Ostpolitik, Sophia. What did that mean back then, and does it mean anything now?
That's a great question. So I think Scholz's initial instincts on Russia were very much in line with the course of the CDU-Merkel government. You know, a mix of dialogue with Russia, red lines, and consequences should those red lines be crossed. And Scholz invoked Willy Brandt and Helmut Schmidt in their Ostpolitik when he talked about this course in his election campaign. And in the SPD, especially, Ostpolitik has had very positive connotations for a long time. This idea that a closer relationship with Russia would eventually lead to a political opening and rapprochement, which is sometimes summarized by Wandel durch Handel, change through trade now. It's more controversial in other circles, clearly, especially when it seemed to result in Germany trying to separate economic interests and geopolitical dynamics like it did with Nord Stream 2. It seemed also as an exclusionary approach, you know, that sidelined Central and Eastern European countries in the relationship between Berlin and Moscow. And Scholz, in response to this, has proposed a European Ostpolitik. I think especially in the last 15 years or so, since the Russian invasion of Georgia and then the Krim and now Putin's war in Ukraine, the ideas at the heart of this German-Russia policy seem pretty naive and outdated. That's clearly the case with regard to Germany's energy dependence on Russia. One thing I think that is true that you hear in SPD circles now is that the Ostpolitik of Brandt was only possible and dependent on Germany's own strength, right? So when Willy Brandt was chancellor, Germany spent more than 3% of its GDP on defense, and that's at least a starting point. But the reality is that today's Russia, that Putin's government is not the Soviet Union circa Brandt. As long as he's in power, it's hard to see how economic interdependence and security, you know, with Russia, not against it, can be possible.
Daniela, this costs. It costs in terms of extra military spending, and it costs a lot in terms of finding new sources of energy and doing without some old sources. How much support, political support in Germany, is there for bearing those costs?
I think there is a growing understanding that defence spending needs to be on a higher level than it used to be over the past decade, simply because the world around us has changed. But I think from this initial public opinion data, which is generally supportive, we cannot conclude that the job of political communication is done with that big speech and a few follow-up interviews and other speeches. I think the task will be for this government for a number of years to re-explain over and over again why we have to get used to a new situation, why we have to spend more, but also why we have to acknowledge we are sitting in a more risky and a more dangerous neighborhood, and that this requires a fundamental review of policy. And so Olaf Scholz has been more present recently in the media, at press conferences, and I think he will have to continue to do that, because there might be a backlash when people feel that energy prices rise. Maybe we will have moments where we will be sitting in the cold. We do not know that. There may be a backlash, and there may fundamentally be the question on the table, should we have not accommodated Russia in a different way? And I think this is a danger. That's why this explanation has to be out there, what Russia is to Europe today, and that it is right to support Ukraine with this war.
Sophia.
I believe Germans want a government that shows them how we could go forward, right? Now that the bubble is popped, how do we get out of free fall? And Scholz and his coalition partners may not have picked this challenge when they got elected, but that's now going to be their project for the next 4 years.
That was Sophia Besch with Daniela Schwarzer. And my thanks to them and to Sir Paul Lever and Markus Zehner. We'll be back at the same time next week. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Octavia Woodward. The programme was mixed by James Beard. The editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon. And if you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds.
Hello, I'm Lucy Worsley, and I want to tell you about Lady Killers. It's a new series from BBC Radio 4. It's a programme that mixes true crime with history, but with a twist. With our all-female team of experts, I am re-examining the crimes of Victorian murderesses through the eyes of 21st century feminists. What can we learn from these women, and would it be any different today? Listen to Lady Killers on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.